Amne, what was your experience growing up in East Jerusalem?
For me to grow up in Jerusalem, being born after 1967, has not been a very delightful experience. Bearing in mind that the only thing you encounter as a child are the symptoms of occupation, being checked at every passage in the old city, or being saying that you're a Palestinian, people, the Israelis will say, no, you are an Arab. Saying that you belong here, they will say, no, this is a Jewish, the capital of the Jewish state. And seeing people who have built their own homes on their own property being demolished, or their land being confiscated. So you start to question, what's wrong here? What's wrong with this place? And I remember me going to my mother and saying, isn't this our country? And she said, yes. I said, why we are treated like this? And then, from there, I started to question, what's the real thing that makes me different from an Israeli? And I think it is very much to do with inequality and injustice.
What have been practical difficulties, say, in daily life for you?
You know, I remember as a child, I'm going to school, and they are considered to be public governmental schools. But these schools are run by the Israeli municipality of Jerusalem. So if I say I'm Palestinian, this is not something that you are supposed to say. And if I'm saying this is the map of Palestine, you are giving a book saying that this is Israel. It's very difficult for a child to say, Mom, you are saying this is Palestine, and they say in school this is Israel. At the end, the Israeli municipality allowed us to learn using the Jordanian curriculum. And this has been done only after an agreement was done with the Jordanians that they will omit anything related to Palestine in terms of geography and identity. So these are one of the basic things that you face as a student in the elementary school, saying that you want to express your identity that you learn at home in your Arabic, and then you go to school and you are faced with another reality where the teacher will tell you, let's keep politics aside. So these are some of the basic things, but imagine yourself going to, with your mother or your brother to the marketplace in the old city of Jerusalem, and then the soldiers will stop your brother and say, give me your ID. If your brother is not yet 16, but he looks a bit older, then they wouldn't believe that he doesn't have an ID. And then you will stay like this, a small child, waiting and looking at the soldier and saying, would he let us in, out? He will take my brother to prison, he wouldn't. He will take us for interrogation or not. So all these fears, you develop a culture of fear and question why. But I tell you that the thing that have struck me mostly as a child was the invasion of Lebanon in 1982. Because I was the smallest in the I'm the smallest in the family, and everyone was shocked about what is happening in Lebanon, and I didn't understand. At that time, what's happening? What does it mean to invade Lebanon? What does it mean to destroy the PLO in Lebanon and all of that? And I felt that we are left alone. Everyone was saying, where are the Arabs? Where are the international community? Where? And from then, I started to say, why are we waiting for others to help us? We should help ourselves. And this is why I think in the first intifada, I've become active as a secondary school student, saying that, yes, we have to do it ourselves. We shouldn't wait for the others. And we have to develop our ways of resistance to occupation, ways that respect human rights, that aim to restore justice, and are inclusive.
And as a woman, what drew you to become involved with the Jerusalem Center for Women?
I think I cannot say, but it's only politics. I think it's also social. I believe that a Palestinian Arab woman have many fronts to struggle at. One of them is the social, and one of is the political. And the political is speaking about the internal Palestinian politics, and political in terms of peace building. And the social is when you speak about equality for Palestinian Arab women, Muslim women in a Palestinian society. And I think the struggles on these three levels are very much connected, and you cannot separate, and you cannot make them a priority. They have to go hand in hand. You cannot say, I will finish occupation and then go to and address the issue of women's emancipation and women's rights. Rights are rights, before, during, and after occupation.
What are the main activities that the Jerusalem Center for Women have been involved with?
You know, Jerusalem Center for Women has two tracks of activities. One that seeks women empowerment through training programs on women's rights, human rights in general, democracy and advocacy, and running campaigns for women's rights and against violations of human rights committed by the Israelis in Jerusalem. The second is the peace-building program, which is based on political dialogue between Palestinian and Israeli political activists so that we can promote a vision for a just peace.
And what common ground have you found with Israelis?
I think the common ground is respect for international law, respect for values. We adopted the two-state solution without settlements, and with Jerusalem serving as two capitals for two states. And we didn't find an agreement over the issue of right of return, because we Palestinians believe that we have this right have to be recognized and accepted, bearing in mind that it is in conformity with international law, and the Israeli partners refuse to accept. And they have reservations on major issues when it comes to the right of return.
You've been quite involved with the issue of political prisoners, haven't you?
Which is women Palestinian detainees. And for the last 2 years, we have been running a program where we visit women political prisoners, we document their stories, we advocate for their basic rights inside the prison, taking our term of reference, the First Geneva Convention, and trying to advocate and lobby for respect of their rights through different groups locally and internationally.
What kind of stories have you been coming across?
You know, it struck me, one of the stories that where a woman who gave birth inside prison, she said that she was treated badly during all the pregnancy, and she wasn't given any special treatment either in terms of food provision or providing hygienic atmosphere or anything of that sort. But even when she gave birth, they gave her almost half an hour during the delivery, and then they handcuffed her half an hour after that. And she says how much she was humiliated during the whole process, where she was having her first baby, none of their family was around, and she was handcuffed just a few minutes before she gave delivery and after she gave delivery. And her son stayed with her for two years, and then he had to go outside because they allow him to stay for 2 years. And she was speaking about how much she was attached to, but at the same time she doesn't want him to stay with her. She wants him to live a free life. This is one of the stories that I never forget. Other women also speak about how they've been tortured during interrogation, how have been intimidated of being raped.
So far, politics has been very male-dominated. They haven't sorted out the problems. How could women do better?
By giving a space for women to participate, and by giving a space for civil society to participate. I think men, masculinity, militarism have been in charge, and this have brought us to total power politics system. I think if we want to make a change, especially we Palestinians, we have to open up to the society that is living the consequences of occupation and dispersion, and be inclusive, bringing all sectors of society to the resistance movement and to participation in decision making. And women have a lot to say about what's happening to them and how a settlement should be based on, because we want a settlement that will look into issues of human rights, respect of human rights, into development, into human security, something that has been totally missing during all the negotiations in the past. So the idea is that how can a moral dimension be brought into the politics of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict? How can we incorporate human rights? How can we incorporate human security?
Sharif Omar, tell me what area you come from in Palestine.
I came from Jayous. It's a small village situated in the east north of Kalkili. My village is in the close area of the Green Line. Because of this, the wall isolated 75% of Jayous lands. In this map, you can see it's a Sofim settlement. It is now 185 houses. For some months ago, they announced that they will build 1,500 houses as expansion. According to the map, it will be expanded 3 kilometers to the north, 3 kilometers to the east. And what does this mean? This means all the farmers who used to pass gate 25 that is situated here will not be able to pass through the houses which they are planned to build them. So we will not be able to reach all our areas behind the new settlement. This is very clear that they don't want us to have the land. And this is very clear that this wall is political borders.
So the wall's kind of zigzagging here, isn't it?
You see, it is really snaking. Because, first of all, they want all our underground water wells. Water there is some of security for Israelis. They don't want us to have the water. Jayous have 6 underground water wells, and all of them are behind the wall. In the other side of the wall, this is Jayous. We haven't any well, and from 1967 up to now, we are not allowed to drill a new well. Add to this that in 1983, they make water meters and fix them on our wells and limit for us the quantity we are allowed to pump it. So they didn't put in consideration that 1990, it will be the Gulf War and all Palestinians who live in Kuwait will come back to Jayous or to their villages. And they need to plant their lands again. They didn't put in mind that in Intifada, farmer workers who used to work inside Israel lose their opportunities. And because of this, they stop going to Israel. And they again want to plant their farms to have an income. And also they forget the normal growth in the society. Because of this, now if you will visit Jayous, you will see a lot of farms without planting. And other farms are planted. Why? Because we make this in turn, one by one. I will plant my land this year, you will plant your land in the coming year, because we haven't enough water to plant all our lands. Because of this, it is sneaking to isolate the water wells. It is sneaking also to have the tops of the mountains so as to easy control and observe any motion there. And you know, in the cities, the wall is 8 meters high of concrete and a lot of towers. And in these towers, you can see the soldiers, a lot of cameras, well-developed cameras. But in the country, it is not a wall of concrete. We have another barbed wire fences, one to the east, one to the west. And after those two barbed wire fences, we have the trenches. They are drilled trenches with the depth of 2 to 3 meters. And in every fence, you have a gate. So wherever you want to go, you have to pass 3 gates. Unfortunately, any farmer who once was arrested, he is not allowed to have a permit. Any worker who can't have Israeli documents that he owns the land in the other side of the wall will never have a permit. Merchants who used to come to buy our products from our farms after the beginning of the Second Intifada, because from the beginning of the Second Intifada, we are not allowed to go to our cities, so we can't sell our products there. Now, even this opportunity, which it was okay for us, the merchants now stopped coming to our farms to buy our products, because on the permit, they fixed the number of the gate you are allowed to use it. So, as example, Jayu's gate is 25. I am not allowed to use gate 26, which is also for Jayu's and Azun. So merchants from outside Jayu's are not allowed to come to buy our products. This is a problem. Because of this, now we are suffering from the very, very cheap prices. In the same time, Israeli trucks, which is it easy to recognize them by their yellow number plates, can pass through the Israeli checkpoints and allowed to enter Nablus as example. And they sell their products for our people there. One of my sons, he's a lecturer, he teaches the law at Al-Najah University in Nablus. He told me that he buys the kilo of tomatoes with the 3 shekels. Me, I can't get 3 shekels from the 15 kilograms packed in one box. Why? Because I sell in the villages, and the Israelis sell in our cities. This is unfair competition.
Before the wall, Sharif, was there not a peaceful coexistence between the Israelis and Palestinians in your area?
In one of our non-violence resistance that I led there, we ask the Israeli officer that day we make a set in on the road to prevent the Israeli bulldozers to uproot our olives. And then 7 jeeps came, and the commander shouted, "Who is responsible here? Where is the mayor? He's in Jayus, he's not here. And who are you? I'm a farmer. Come in." I went there with a woman named Lisa. She is Jewish from California, but she's very, very active. And that day she was the negotiator in behalf of the internationals. "Why are you making violence?" he shouted. "No, this is not violence. We are sitting in the road to prevent your bulldozers to abort our lives." "This is violence." "No, this is not violence. Can you tell me, please, why you want to abort our lives?" He said, "No, in fact, what we needed is to build the wall to give peace for both Palestinians and Israelis." "Excuse me, sir. If it is really to have the peace for Palestinian Israelis, me, as representative for the farmers in Jayus, I'm ready to pay you 50% of the cost if you will build the wall on the borders next to Jayus lands." He was so nervous. And at that moment, Lisa began a discussion with him. She said, "All the time in USA media, we read about Israel, the democratic state, the state respecting human rights. Can I ask you which laws you use here with the Palestinians?" He said, "I use the laws that guarantee protection and safety for my soldiers. Can I have a list?" "No, they are not listed. Only the need oblige me to have the laws." She said, "I'm sorry, I feel ashamed to see that and to hear it. I'm a Jewish. I can't believe that." He said, "If you are really Jewish, come back to your home Israel and don't believe this liar." She looked her head and said, "I can't understand if he is a liar or not." This is example. In the south side of Jayus, in one of another non-violence resistance, it was participated by a lot of Israelis. In the south side of Jayus, it's 6.5 kilometers far from the Green Line, but 28 meters only far from the houses. That day we planted a small olive nursery where they aborted the olives. The mayor of Jayus, and representative of internationals, and representative of Israelis. And that day, also, we asked him this question. The commander, he's not the same commander. "Can you tell me, please, why you are building the wall so close to the houses?" He said, "This is simply to prevent clashes between Palestinians and Israelis." I wondered, and I asked him, "Please, Can you tell me how you believe that 6 kilometers and a half are not enough to prevent the clashes, but you expect that 28 meters will be enough to do it? The answer was a lot of tear gas shells. And that day, three of the internationals were fainted. One of them is Raymond from Ireland. He has 12 stitches because he fell down from one of the tear walls after he was fainted. This is an example.
Chris, you've been involved with the International Solidarity Movement. Can you tell me a little bit about the work that they do?
Okay, we try and do two things, basically. We try and provide humanitarian assistance to Palestinians. We also try and highlight the situation and get their story out to the world. And we do that by actually travelling to the West Bank and Gaza, the occupied territories, and we undertake a range of actions which would range from staying with families who are likely to be attacked, helping people live their normal lives that's very difficult to do if you're living under curfew or under occupation. So, you know, just helping them harvest their olives or their crops. But we also try and dramatize what's happening. I mean, often we'll be the only people there on the ground in the occupied territories. There may well be no journalists there because they're scared to go there. So we might be the only way that Palestinians can get stories out of what's actually happening on the ground. The way it works really is the fact that we're internationals, we have a kind of privileged position. The Israelis view us in a racist way, so Palestinians they can kill with impunity. But if they shoot somebody from the UK or America or Sweden, then that's a news story, and they can't just bury it. So by the fact that we're there, we can act as protection for Palestinians.
And yet, it seems to me a lot of people, including myself, wouldn't have the courage to actually go out there and put themselves on the line as you do.
I mean, we've made a film, Jeremy Hardy versus the Israeli Army. If you go and see that film, you might think that all we do is we stand in front of tanks and get shot at, but it's not all like that. It's a lot of the work might just be visiting families who've had one of the family members killed or seriously injured, hearing their story, you know, just actually listening to them so that they feel that they're being heard by the outside world and being able to come back and tell other people their story. So, and a lot of the time, you know, you might, you know, you could be working in the media office. There's other things that can be done. I mean, besides standing in front of tanks. I mean, we obviously do that. We do confront the military, and the Israeli military is a very powerful military. It's the fourth or fifth most powerful in the world. So there's no denying there's danger in what we do. But I think lots of people do go out there, lots of ordinary people. And it's very interesting how broad the movement is. You know, it's not just the usual suspects, it's not the usual protesters. I mean, people, you know, people like that are there. I'm very glad they are there. But also, you know, it attracts people from a range of backgrounds, Jewish, Muslim, secular, Christians, and from people who are working in the city, for instance, who you just think are not necessarily, who are quite mainstream politically in their views, but just have somehow heard or understood something about the issue and think that they've got to do something to stop it.
The International Solidarity Movement, though, although it's international, it was actually set up by Israelis and Palestinians.
That's right. The the founders were three individuals, Hawaida Araf, who's an Israeli Palestinian, and Netta Golan, who is an Israeli married to a Palestinian, and Ghassan Andoni, who's a Palestinian. And what they did was they were involved in different ways in trying to bring about, you know, peace and reconciliation. And towards the end of the Oslo peace process, became more and more disillusioned with what they were doing and wanted to do something more proactive. It's actually a very young movement. It was set up in the summer of 2001.
And what's been the response from the Palestinian people that you've been with?
Generally, very, very warm. Palestinians are extremely glad to see you there. I mean, they've been calling for many, many years now for an international observer force who would act as some kind of protection for them as they live under military occupation. So the fact that we turn up, not in an official UN capacity, but at least as an international, effectively an international observer force, they're very, very glad to have us there. Where I was in December, in an area called Zeta, which is a small village near what's called the Green Line, which would be the border between Israel and Palestine if Palestine was a state. The Palestinian farmers living in that village actually heard that we were in the area, and they asked us to come, and they demolished part of the apartheid wall that's being built using bulldozers, and they knew that without us there they'd be shot, and by the fact that we were there, nothing happened to them. We were able to bulldoze a way through to their farmland, which they hadn't been able to get to for 3 weeks. So, and they were extremely appreciative and understood the value of our presence.
I mean, given such negative circumstances, it must be a real challenge to keep a positive attitude about the whole situation.
It does feel as though we are progressing. I mean, at first, we couldn't really understand why the Israeli army allowed us to move around and travel around and weren't taking more of an active interest in what we were doing. If we were winning, or if we were having any impact, then surely they'd be trying to stop us. And now they really are trying to stop us, and it feels it's reached a stage where they see us as a threat. And the head of the Israeli army has issued a statement saying that ISM are interfering with their freedom of action on the ground in the occupied territories. You know, naming the organization and saying that we're stopping them doing what they want to do. And that's fantastic, because we are, that's part of what we're trying to do. We're trying to stop an illegal military occupation from being imposed. So I think we can take, obviously there's a downside to that, and that is that we're facing, you know, we're under attack and threat from the army, in a way which we weren't before. But I think it's very positive to think that they've recognized that we're a threat. I mean, if you look back at the anti-apartheid movement, there's a role model there for us and for activists and people to follow, and maybe these are the last throes of the apartheid regime in Palestine. So that's what keeps me hoping.